Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, the community, and most importantly, the people. So, stay tuned.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss public procurement as part of a free trade agreement of India with different countries. And we shall also take a look at, contrary to the BJP claims, deterioration in the economic and security state of Jammu and Kashmir.
A free trade agreement pact signed between India and the UAE last year has set alarm bells ringing for the big Indian companies. Being India's third largest trading partner, New Delhi last year opened UAE's access to India's public procurement market, displaying a major shift in its trade policy stance. Exports benefiting from the India-UAE free trade pact accounted for about 60% of New Delhi's total non-oil shipments to Abu Dhabi in the December quarter last year.
The India-UAE Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement aims to increase bilateral trade to $100 billion from the current $60 billion in the next 5 years. The UAE is currently the third largest trading partner of India and second largest export destination. After keeping the public procurement market out of FTAs for a long time, India recently opened up access to public tenders over $2 billion to foreign companies as part of the negotiations. Big Indian business houses now face the challenge of foreign competition in acquiring government contracts as Delhi has extended national treatment to the UAE companies. Experts say that maintaining the $2 billion limit will safeguard small and medium-sized industries from the pressure of foreign competition.
We see basically moves that are playing out which seem to be calculated to give a fundamental business advantage to Atlantic world corporations, which are no longer able to compete with emerging economies. So when these deals are done, It's basically kowtowing again to Uncle Sam and the British and the French, and for that matter, Israel and the Economic Union, which have, of course, have had over 500 years of dominance to get things right and have done nothing but mess up. And I have to confess, as a person of European descent, you know, I'm part of that and I'm taking the benefit of it. But it's time for a change. And the kind of change that's required is not breaking down traditional values in regional countries and clearing the way or so that multinational corporations from the United States and Great Britain and Europe more generally can come in and do business with billionaires in places like India, so that at the top end of the human scrap heap, They're lapping it all up and doing well and saying GDP is growing, while people at the bottom are suffering more than ever with rising prices and lower wages. So I don't think this is the way to go. I see it happening around the world. I see it happening here in Indonesia. I see a calculated effort to break down traditional values and clear the way with false promises for Western corporations to come in and cover the field and establish monopolies and oligopolies that basically put small businesses out of business.
According to Indian economists, foreign firms won't be able to compete with the local firms, thus incurring higher costs compared to national companies. Underwater structure projects involving large-scale medical equipment or artificial intelligence are the areas where the foreign companies have an edge over the local businesses. Cost being the major factor, the competition in majority of sectors is with ASEAN countries or China. As per the agreement, procurement has been open to UAE companies in 34 central government ministries, including Ministry of Economic Affairs, New and Renewable Energy, Power, etc.
Allowing access to the UAE to procure government tenders has resulted in the opening of the floodgates to similar demands from other countries India is negotiating with. These include the European Union, the UK and Australia. The agreement with the UAE is being used as a benchmark by other negotiating countries. Additionally, countries with which India already has FTAs may push for including access to $500 billion Indian government procurement market in the agreement.
In a surprising move, India and the European Union resumed negotiations in June 2022 for a free trade agreement after almost a decade. EU's demands include inclusion of concessions extended to other FTA partners, namely UAE, along with duty cuts on automobiles, dairy products. India also has ongoing talks with the UK, Australia, and Canada. All these countries are eyeing the Indian central government procurement market. According to the Indian government officials, the UK and EU will not negotiate if the public procurement market is kept out of the trade talks. Australia has also been asking for similar access as given to the UAE.
Well, I think it's very difficult to ever conceive of a situation that has large corporations facing a threat from smaller, more efficient companies. I don't think the business sector, the private sector works that way. The way corporatism works basically is huge corporations come into a country, whether it's by making promises or through corrupt payments or whatever it takes, and initially perform in order to be able to say, look, we're delivering a better product at the lower price, which helps everybody, including consumers. But once they've established themselves, they're like a caterpillar or a moth. They metamorphosize into something horrible that destroys all other possibilities, including local smaller businesses. It's very difficult for small businesses to survive, let alone threaten the supremacy of big corporations in a place where corporations have been allowed to come in and basically dominate the roost. So I don't see there being a scenario once these multinational corporations start coming in and doing trade with India, which understandably is primarily concerned about its own economic interests, that sees ordinary small businesses and medium-sized businesses and domestic businesses and individuals protected from what's going to play out. This is all part of the grander scheme for U.S. hegemony, or if you like, Atlantic world hegemony, where everybody's dancing to a set of rules that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FTAs, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now let's switch to social media and see what people around the world had to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK, and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, "UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one." Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, "People aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK." Mint, a news portal, wrote, "The inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies."
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group's strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of four civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. Two more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the Union Territory directly ruled by the center on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian pandits, Kashmiri pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about the domiciles and the residents. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that, that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited the Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu, fascist, and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, and they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which I think which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment. While destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy, how can you actually improve the economic condition of the state, the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense, that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods, and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years, as claimed by the BJP government. So has the centre's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir, but the Kashmiri people never, ever, bore down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination, and this is the will of the people. You know, whatever India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot, policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in the past, in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them their the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took the Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms, and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council, now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums, which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, if we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually help the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri youth. There was a time that then there was a mix of non-Kashmiri and Kashmiri militants. Now we are seeing that majority of the militants operating in Kashmir are purely the Kashmiri youth. So that is a phenomena which changed during the BJP's government, that more youth is being radicalized in Kashmir and they are joining different militant groups. And this is for the first time and the history of Kashmir that during BJP's government, we have seen the presence of Daesh in Kashmir and we have seen presence of Al-Qaeda in Kashmir. It never happened. So that is the level of, suppression and depression among the Kashmiri youth, which can actually become catastrophic for India and for the region as well. So that is something which is new in Kashmir, and that is the result of the BJP's policies.
There you have it, Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sharp Media Network tweeted, "No developments in Indian illegally occupied Jammu and Kashmir during last 4 years. The last 4 years have ruined the entire economy of Jammu and Kashmir, which has in reality collapsed. Unemployment is at its peak and youth is in utter frustration. Frontier Indica wrote, "It's no secret that under Modi, the security situation in Punjab has gotten much worse, and the benefits of revocation of Article 370 vis-a-vis the safety of common people in J&K, especially KPs, have also been short-lived." The Wire, a prominent news portal, tweeted, "The people of Kashmir say silence, fear, rising prices, and unemployment have taken over the region after August 5, 2019. Jammu-based Reserve Category employee working in Kashmir tweeted, "Situation in Kashmir is not yet conducive, but still being forced to resume duties. I don't know why. We are not with any Z security and weapon to defend ourselves, still forced by stopping salaries. Our life is also valuable to our old parents, if yours matters to your parents."
And that was our episode about the FTA's public procurement and the apprehensions of Indian business houses, and also the worrying economic and security situation in Jammu and Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has intensified its invasions against Palestinians as part of a pattern of extrajudicial assassination of Palestinian resistance fighters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, "On February 23rd, city streets in the West Bank, East Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip were silent. Palestinians had declared a general strike and a day of mourning in light of the Zionist regime's invasion of one of the West Bank's most ancient cities the day before, which left 11 Palestinians dead and over 102 people injured. On the morning of February 22nd, the Zionist regime forces invaded Nablus. It started with an undercover special operations unit, infiltrating the old city in the early dawn hours, searching for fighters from the Lion's Den resistance group. Hours later, the special operations force located two resistance fighters that had just walked into Habala quarter of the old city, Hossam Bassam Islam, 24, and Muhammad Omar Jonaidi Abu Bakr, 23. By approximately 10 a.m., the undercover Israeli regime teams moved in for the kill. An armed confrontation ensued as the two fighters were holed up in a house in the city. The Zionist regime special forces summoned reinforcements 20 minutes into the operation, and that's when the larger-scale onslaught began, as the Zionist regime's military vehicles flooded the city. According to eyewitnesses from Nablus and Balata refugee camp, more than 50 Israeli regime military vehicles launched a full-fledged land invasion of Nablus while imposing a closure on entry and exit points to the city. Three fighters were killed during the confrontation in Habala quarter, as a third comrade of Junaidi and Slim, 23-year-old Walid Dakhil, had joined the fight in the middle of the exchange of fire. Other resistance fighters from Nablus-based resistance groups, such as Nablus Brigade and Balata Brigade, were also killed during armed confrontations with the Zionist regime's military throughout the city. All the while, the Zionist regime's army conduct throughout the city was violent and indiscriminate, as the Israeli troops fired at bystanders and killed several non-combatants while injuring countless others. By 1:30 p.m., the army began its retreat, leaving devastation in its wake. All told, the Zionist regime army killed 11 Palestinians in Nablus, 10 on the day of invasion, with the 11th succumbing to his wounds the following day. More than 100 Palestinians were injured, including at least three journalists. 85 of the injuries were with live ammunition, with six in critical condition, according to the Palestinian Ministry of Health. Seven of the slain were resistance fighters, identified as Muhammad Khaled Anbusi, 25, Tamar Nemr Ahmad Menavi, 33, Mus'ab Munir Muhammad Uwais, 26, Jasser Jamil Abdul Wahab Qanar, 23, Hussam Basim Islam, 24, Walid Riaz Hussein Dakhil, 23, and Muhammad Abu Bakr Junaidi, 23. The other four Palestinian non-combatants were killed by the Israeli regime army throughout the invasion. Three of them were elderly men, identified as Adnan Sabah Bara, 72, Abdul Hadi Abdul Aziz Al Ashqar, 61, and 66-year-old Anan Sakwat Anab, who died the day following the invasion from respiratory injuries due to the tear gas inhalation. The fourth non-combatant was a minor, identified as Muhammad Farid Sha'ban, 16. According to the Zionist regime's military, two Israeli troops were also injured during the confrontations. The Zionist regime army said the extrajudicial assassination mission was launched upon receiving intelligence concerning the whereabouts of Mohammad Junaidi and Hossam Islam, who were wanted by the Shin Bet. The home where the armed youth had made their last stand now lies in ruins, water pipes flooding the area. Standing on the rubble of what was once a staircase, a friend and comrade of Junaidi shows people a video of the slain man from the night before. Remains of the man's last meal can be seen among the rubble. When they were encircled in Habala quarter of the old city, Islam and Junaidi were in the company of another younger resistance fighter, Walid Dakhil, 23. Dakhil's body was riddled with bullets. Although not the target, he confronted the troops in an attempt to help his friends survive. Moving slowly and gently with his friends in his jacket, Dakhil's younger brother looked a lot like the photos of Walid. He was so loving, Dakhil told Mundo Weiss as he moved to the site of his brother's assassination. Guiding the way toward the Habala quarter of the old city, Walid's 21-year-old brother clenched his jaw when recalling the slaughter of that morning. His chin seemed to unlock only as he shared tidbits of his brother in more intimate settings with friends. "He loved life," he said. "My brother, he loved life," he repeated, in case it didn't resonate the first time. "He loved to laugh," Walid's younger sibling interjected, chuckling, saying, "He used to always crack jokes to make those around him laugh too." The Zionist regime military claimed the three men had posed a threat to the Israeli lives, albeit without providing evidence. At the same time, the Shin Bet claims that the Lion's Den no longer poses a serious threat to the Zionist regime. Additional statements from the Zionist regime military justified the extrajudicial assassination on the grounds that the men had refused to turn themselves in. Meanwhile, Wafa News Agency reported that recently, Israeli extremist settlers committed about 300 violations against Palestinians and their properties in the towns of Hawara, Burin, Asira al-Qabliya, south of the occupied West Bank city of Nablus, Hassan Douglas, who monitors settlement activities in the northern West Bank. Douglas told Wafa that Israeli settlers recently launched a massive attack against Palestinians, burning houses, assaulting citizens, which resulted in the killing of a Palestinian man identified as Sameh Akbash, 37, and injuring more than 100 others. He added that the Zionist settlers targeted 30 houses, stoning some and burning down ours in Hubara. The fanatic settlers also burned 15 vehicles. Douglas noted that the settlers burnt a barn, three vehicles, and attempt to set fire to a house in Burin, while in Asira al-Qabliya, the Zionist settlers burned a house and a water tank and caused damages to vehicles in Odala town.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the Islamic rules or laws about purity according to Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And Sheikh Sawid, our guest speaker, we are still talking about the rules of purification according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Well, Sheikh Sawid, what is the rule, what is the jurisprudential law concerning an interval of time which may separate the wiping and or the washing of different body parts during wudu or even ghusl?
Wudu and ghusl are two different things, okay?
Right.
The rules applying to ghusl are different from those applying to wudu. There is no problem in any interval or time gap between the parts of ghusl. You know, for example, it's not necessary to observe succession or consecutiveness during ghusl. To give you an example or to explain it further, if you, for example, wash your head now and your head and neck now, and then after an hour you wash the right side of your body, and then after another hour you wash the left side of your body, your ghusl is in order. It's valid. But this is not the case with wudu. Wudu will be invalid if there is a delay in completing it. And if there is such a delay that, you know, the previously washed or wiped body parts dry up, then of course the wudu becomes invalid and you cannot perform prayers with it. So I think I give you a very live example of some ladies, for example, who, when it comes to ghusl, and this is a very practical example.
Right.
Some ladies, for example, use nail polish, and they remove the nail polish, thinking that there is no substance left on their nail plates. But after, let's say, 1 hour or after they pray, they see some substances left still on their nail and their nails, and they think, okay, what should I do? Is this a barrier? Is this an impediment?
Mm-hmm.
Should I remove it or not?
Yes.
According to all religious authorities, this barrier has to be removed and ghusl should be repeated. But what does it mean to repeat? Now, is it necessary to go to start from the beginning, wash the head, and then do everything again? No, it's not necessary. What is necessary is to remove that substance and then wash that part with the intention of completing the ghusl.
Mm-hmm.
And that's enough. You know, maybe 10 hours have passed, and yes, you have done many things, okay? You have been to the bathroom, and you have done many things. But if you want to complete the ghusl, you just need to remove that substance and wash only that part of mm-hmm. your finger or nail with the intention of completing the ghusl. Your ghusl is in order.
So the interval of time doesn't apply to ghusl?
Yes, doesn't apply to ghusl. And it does not affect ghusl. Ghusl will be in order.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay, yes. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back to continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of purification according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, what is the duty of a person suffering from a continuous discharge of gas, though in a small amount, when it comes for that individual to offer prayers or even make wudu before the prayer?
Well, the discharge of gas, whether it is a small amount of gas or a large amount, it does not make any difference because your wudu becomes void, mm-hmm. you know. And this state of being unable to control oneself is, in legal parlance or in legal terminology, is called incontinence.
Mm-hmm.
So, in the event that one suffers from this kind of flatulation or incontinence, a person should see whether he can restrain himself for a short period of time or not. He can make wudu and then quickly jump into action and perform prayers.
Mm-hmm.
And if he cannot keep his wudu until the end of the prayer, and the renewal of wudu or making wudu once again proves to be very difficult or very hard, then he can pray one prayer with one wudu.
Mm-hmm.
One prayer with one wudu. Even if, for example, he passes wind in the middle of that very prayer, okay? Even if he discharges gas in the middle of that prayer, he can go ahead, and of course his wudu, his prayer is valid.
Mm.
But then in order to offer the next prayer, he should
also make another
wudu. He should make another wudu and then continue with the prayer even if he discharges wind in the middle.
I see. Okay, thank you for that answer. And there is another question, which is regarding living in apartment houses. You know, lots of people these days cannot hold or cannot own their own personal houses and yards, for example. So they have to live vertically, basically, not horizontally, like in apartment houses in residential areas, right?
Yeah.
So some of these people, have to pay for the expenses of the whole complex, right? In addition to the rent, for example, in addition to like buying the house, that kind of, large amount of money that you have to pay to either buy it or like for the lease of the house, right? But in addition to these expenditures, then you have to pay for the expenses of the whole complex. There are watchmen, for example. There are people who are like in charge of the cleaning, for example, the whole apartment house or the buildings. Yeah, the bills and the stuff like that, you know, so on and so forth. And in case a few people may not cooperate with the whole complex residents, and they do not share, for example, all right, and they do not pay for those additional expenses, are these people's prayers or any other religious services that they do in those apartments, in those complexes, valid, do you think? And what does Islam say according these situations, based on these situations?
Well, that's a good question. According to Islamic Sharia and Islamic law, of course, each person is liable for paying the expenses of the common facilities or the amenities as much as he uses, you know, water, gas, electricity, cleaning services, and other, services rendered by the watchmen or other people who are responsible, to take care of the building, And in the event that a person, let's say one of the neighbors, wants not to pay the cost of the water, for example, His Eminence says that, of course, his wudu and ghusl are invalid because he is considered to have, used the water without paying for it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kind of illicit use of the water. You know, as long as he continues to make unlawful use of the water and not paying the bills, not paying for the costs, then his wudu and ghusl will be definitely affected according to His Eminence. And therefore, not only is he liable, but his wudu and ghusl will also be affected.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Chavit, for your nice contribution to the program, Islamic Laws. I always pick your brain for these questions, which are pertaining to the rules of irrigation, and you provide us with your insight and your knowledge as to these questions of jurisprudence based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Thank you very much for that. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We bid you farewell, and from me and the rest of the crew, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم من جاء إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير لا إله إلا هو رحيم محيي المميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.